I want to devote the rest of our time to our distinguished guest, Norman Mock. And Norman has an extremely long history in Sabre. And as an article in the National Pastime once said, that he has lived a baseball life that all of us may envy. It began in a minor league broadcast booth alongside Ernie Harwell and extended to front office stops in Leonard, Alabama, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and Knoxville, Tennessee. It continued through the writing of more than 30 baseball books, many of them for young people, on up to a magisterial three-volume biography of Connie Mack, with whom Mock may now be said to share the title of the Grand Old Man of Baseball. Indeed, his meticulously researched multi-volume biography may occupy in baseball literature a position of parallel standing with those of Carl Sandburg on Lincoln, Douglas Southall Friedman on Washington, and Robert Carroll on Lyndon Johnson. Along the way, Mock served 12 years as an officer and director of Sabre between 1992 and 2005, wrote articles for his publication, took a hand in founding two research committees, Oral History and Scouts, and was chairman of the National Convention Committee from 1997 to 2009. He saw his first major league game at the Polo Grounds in 1935, when he was 6 years old. His baseball aspirations took a turn after a Dodgers tryout camp in Cambridge, Maryland. Relying on a great changeup but nothing to change up from, he lasted two-thirds of an inning and was told to come back later when he couldn't throw harder, something they said they couldn't teach. He became a lifelong friend of Ernie Harwell when he was a 21-year-old business manager of an independent team, the Valley Rebels of the Class D Georgia-Alabama League. Mock also made contact with Dick Bartlett, a boyhood hero of his formative New York Giants years, and the two collaborated on Rowdy Richard, a firsthand account of the National League Baseball Wars of the 1930s and the men who fought them, published in 1987. He worked on a couple of books with Brooklyn pitching star Rex Barney and wrote many young adult biographies in the Chelsea House series, Baseball Legends, including volumes on Ty Cobb, Satchel Paige, Babe Ruth, and Lou Gehrig. He has also written, said the article in the National Pastime, several books on topics of less abiding interest than baseball, such as money and banking, in 2001. Since today he is going to speak about Connie Mack versus John McGraw and as managers, it's probably worth mentioning that that Norman has met Connie Mack. Connie Mack, he said, was sitting on a park bench in left field while the team took batting practice. I decided I'd like to meet him. He was 85. I was 18. I walked out and introduced myself and shook hands. I remember bony but not gnarled fingers and sat down. I asked him something about some team that was in the news. It might have been a clubhouse fight or something of that nature. He answered politely, patiently, assuring me that whatever it was wouldn't affect the team's performance on the field. I asked him about that and an 18-year-old's questions devoid of any great insight or import. After a few minutes, I thanked him for the opportunity to talk with him and took my leave. I had no idea that I'd be writing his biography 60 years later. Now, Norman has worked quite a lot on his pre-internet research covering Connie Mack, covering several decades. He jokingly called his work, when he completed his third volume, My 66 Years of Researching Connie Mack. So with that, I'd like to give the floor to Norman, and to thank him for being here.
Well, thank you very much, John. John wears two hats, you know. He's the chairman of the Oral History Committee and the Dead Ball Committee, and which produces, as far as I'm concerned, the best newsletters in all of Sabre. But I want to scotch one rumor right now, that though I'm talking about the dead ball era, and we are here to talk about the dead ball era, contrary to some people's beliefs, I was not an eyewitness to the occasions and the action. I was close, but I was not an eyewitness. Sometime in the 1940s, Connie Mack was often asked to name an all-time all-star team. And he would reply, and I'm not quoting, That's a foolish idea. The game has changed so much, the style of play has changed so much, the equipment, the players, the playing conditions, the playing fields, that it isn't fair to anybody, and it doesn't make any sense to try to pick an all-time team comparing players from the 1930s and 40s with players from the 1890s and the early 1900s. And so he wouldn't do it. And I think he was right. I think it was a good idea. So today, we're here to talk about just picking an all-star team from the dead ball era and taking it down another step. We're going to confine ourselves just to picking a manager. Who would we pick among the managers between 1901 and 1919 to lead an all-star dead ball era team? I've narrowed it down to John McGraw and Connie Mack, although a case can be made for Frank Chance. Frank Chance won four pennants and two World Series in that span, and his winning percentage is actually higher than either Mack's or McGraw's. But McGraw and Mack lead in two other ways. Each of them won six pennants in those 19 years. And McGraw's winning percentage was higher than Mack's. It was almost 600. Mack's was barely over 500. Yet they both won six pennants. They met in three World Series. McGraw won the first one in 1903 behind Christy Mathewson's three shutouts. Mack won in 1911 and in 1913 when the A's caught on to how to bat against Christy Mathewson, and they beat him twice. Hall of Famers, Connie Mack developed six of them, five of them that he signed as rookies, and the sixth one, to be fair, Herb Pennock, he gave up on too soon after only 4 years. But his six Hall of Famers, can you name them? Blank. Just in the dead ball era. Baker, Collins, Plank, Bender, Waddell, and Pennock. McGraw had three, and none of them were from their rookie years on. Can you name them? Mathewson, McGinnity, no, and a catcher, Roger Bresnahan. So Mack had six, five of whom he developed as from rookies up, and McGraw had three. Okay. Similarities. What were the similarities between Mack and McGraw? For one thing, they were aggressive, rule-bending players. Both of them. McGraw is better known for that than Mack. But where McGraw might grab hold of a base runner's belt as he rounded third base, Mack was an expert at tipping the bat of a batter. Mac was a little bit of a chatterer behind the plate to distract batters. At the time he was playing, the third base coach could run down the baseline toward home plate alongside a base runner going from third to home and do his best to interfere with the catcher if there was any play at the plate. And Mac was very good at that. You don't think of it. You think of him as a player saint or a saint of a player and a manager like he seemed to be sitting in the dugout 60, 70 years later. But as a player, they were very similar. They both had fierce tempers. Again, you don't associate that with Connie Mack. Mack was 11 years older than McGraw. McGraw had something to say. McGraw, if Twitter had been invented then, he would have been the Donald Trump of the time. He had something to say about umpires, league officials, other club owners, and didn't hesitate to sound off. Connie Mack had a fierce temper as a player and a manager. In 1895, in his first year managing the Pittsburgh Pirates, one game in particular, he went out on the field to argue a call at second base. He was thrown out by the umpire. He refused to leave the field. He refused to shut up. They had to summon three policemen to come to escort him off the field, chattering and yelling the whole time. As a manager in the clubhouse, he would lose his temper and ride the players, scold the players, get after them for mistakes they made, and just tear into them. It wasn't effective, and he knew it. He was fired in Pittsburgh, went down to the minor leagues, and was the same way. And he said, this isn't working. The players don't like me. We're not doing as well as we should. I have to do something to change. And what he did was banish himself from the clubhouse after the games. And that's the reason, and that's the time that he began to manage in street clothes so he would not have to go into the clubhouse after the game to change. He would walk the streets instead. He would walk back to where he lived in a hotel in downtown Milwaukee to cool down. This is how he conquered his temper. McGraw simply got older, and it kind of eased off with age. As major league managers, each of them had the final say in player transactions, in player signings, in player salaries. They were on equal footing. How did they differ? John McGraw was a finer. He levied fines. If you missed a sign, it cost you. If you were out after bed check curfew time, it would cost you. He would make changes in the lineup during a game and post the changes in the back of the dugout. And if you didn't look every few innings and you missed it, it would cost you. McGraw had a kind of a fetish take a strike, he would say. He did not like and didn't believe in swinging at the first pitch. And when a batter was going up to the plate, take a strike. Take a strike. He did this for years. One day, an outfielder had Irish Musial. Take a strike. Irish Musial goes up to bat, hits the first pitch out of the ballpark for a home run. McGraw was furious. He said, I told you to take the first pitch. Musial says, I took the first pitch, I took it right out of the ballpark. McGraw says, that'll cost you $100. Musial's fuming. He says, make it 200. McGraw says, it's 200. The clubhouse manager was McGraw's snitch. And anything that he overheard that he thought the boss should know about, the boss found out about. Connie Mack was not a finer. He did not like to take money from the players. He rarely did it. He knew that there was a wife and a family dependent on that money. And he would not find them. Sometimes if he did find them, they wound up getting it back. McGraw emphasized thinking. He had a sign in his office. Had one word on it, think. But the players knew that McGraw did all the thinking. And he let them know it. One day in, I think it was 1921, the Pirates came to New York for a series, six-game series, leading the Giants by about 8 games in the standings. And High Pockets Kelly, first baseman, I think it was 1920. Yeah, but I think this happened in 22. Anyhow, High Pockets Kelly is up to bat. The count gets to 3-0. McGraw flashes him the hit sign. Kelly does not believe it. Kelly says, McGraw had never flashed a hit sign on a 3-0 count. He backs out. He looks in the dugout. He gets the same sign. He still isn't convinced that it isn't going to cost him money if he misreads the sign. And as Kelly tells it, the whole Pittsburgh team must be watching and must know that there's something going on with this sign. So he looks again and he gets the sign again. So he gets back in the batter's box. He hits the 3-0 pitch for a home run. After the game, McGraw never has a compliment for anybody in the clubhouse. McGraw comes by, and everybody had to sit and wait until McGraw was finished saying whatever he had to say before they began to get out of their uniforms. And McGraw comes by and stops and looks at him. Doesn't say good hitting, doesn't say nice home run. Says, if my brains hold out, we'll win this thing. And they swept the 6 games, and they won that pennant. But this was McGraw. Connie Mack respected thinking on the part of his players. Connie Mack would never say a thing like that to his players. He encouraged them to do their own thinking, create their own plays in the field, flash their own hit and run signs, flash their own steal signs between batter and base runner. He didn't mind it, he encouraged it. And he also made a point of finding college players, smart players, much more than McGraw did. These were key differences in their managing styles. McGraw was not close to his players. Everybody was, "You big stiff. Do something today, you big stiff." Even Mathewson, who became one of the few that he felt paternally toward. Later on, Ross Youngs was another, but very few. But he'd say to Christy Mathewson, "You big stiff, pitch a good game today." Everybody was "you big stiff." Mac considered his players like his own sons, treated them that way, respected them that way, did not have private detectives following them. He had to check up on Rubardell a few times, but otherwise, no snitches, and yet he seemed to know what every one of them was up to at all times. But he didn't find them. He didn't yell at them. If he had to talk to them, it was privately in his office. These were the differences, the way they were. Beginning in 1901 to 1919, the dead ball era, John McGraw started out managing Baltimore in the American League. He did not have much of a team. In the middle of 1902, he left the American League, took over as a manager of the Giants, and that's where he was the rest of the time. But he took over an established team. He took over a team that already had a Mathewson and a McGinnity. Connie Mack began in 1901 with zero players. He built a new team from scratch. He won a pennant in his second year. McGraw won his first pennant, in his second year with the Giants in 1903. Not incidentally, the rookie Mathewson in 1901 signed with the new American League Athletics in Philadelphia and took an advance from Connie Mack. But the Giants' ownership got after him and just scared the dickens out of him. We'll ban you from baseball. We'll blackball you. You better not do this. But I already took some money and signed a contract. We'll take care of the advance. We'll see that you pay it back. But you got to renege on that contract. And Mathewson did. And that's how come when John McGraw got there to the Giants, Mathewson was still there. But can you imagine what a different story the dead ball era would have been if the Philadelphia Athletics had a pitching staff of not only Bender and Plank and Waddell and Jack Combs, but Christy Mathewson too, they might have won every year. So, I leave it to you. I come to no conclusion. These were what these two giants of managers were like, alike and not alike. These were their records. These were the kinds of players they had. These were the Hall of Famers they had. So, if you were making out your own dead ball era all-star team, I leave it to you to pick who your manager would be. Any questions? Yeah. Each one of them publicly said he thought the other was the greatest manager in baseball. McGraw quit in 32. He was sick. He didn't live much longer. Mac, of course, managed longer than he should have. So they only knew each other as managers through 1932. Any other questions? Yeah. I was pretty much limiting myself to on the field and handling players and managing players, not getting into the business part of it. Yeah. Well, I agree with Mac in the picking of all-time all-star teams, and I agree with his reasoning for why, how do you choose between Ty Cobb and Joe DiMaggio in center field from such two different eras? Well, that's why. I left it to you. Yeah. It wasn't just a matter of reverence, because he was already he was 38 when he started in Philadelphia. He was already old enough to be the father of a lot of his players in his first year in Philadelphia. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And because he looked specifically, primarily, for young green players off sandlots, off high schools, out of colleges, it didn't take long before he was old enough to be the whole team's father. And so it started very early. And of course, as he got older, even the older players, when he was 60, he had players 35, 40, and by that time, he's Mr. Mack to them as well. There were a few coaches who would call him Connie, but by that time, he had taken on the aura and the stature of being Mr. Mack. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Among the managers, they would call him Connie. Most of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one thing, McGraw was an old-time Baltimore Orioles of the 1890s at heart all his life. And the second thing is, he was not well physically. He was going downhill. Yeah. You mean dead ball era all-star? Well, if we're talking about a combined, a one team, not a National League, not an American League team, but one team, he'd be hard to rank above Eddie Collins. I don't think that you could find enough valid support for either one. I don't think so. I think that, as I said before, Mac delegated more of that to his players than any of McGraw's players would dare take on themselves. But as far as like pinch hitting, changing pitchers, things like that, I don't think there's a fair basis to put one above the other. No, they didn't really. They didn't play each other that much. Didn't see each other that much. The few World Series was about it. But it was the players, more than Mac, who, in 1911, and then again in 1913. Figured out how to hit Mathewson. Figured him out. And it wasn't it wasn't that they had all been there in 1905, but a few of them were. And just from seeing him, particularly from 11 to 13, as to how he pitched to them from game to game, because he had, I forget how many starts he had in 1911, but a guy like Homer and Baker, who couldn't hit him, and then suddenly could hit him. And it wasn't that Matheson changed, it's that these guys got together and figured out how to think with him, what to look for, how to hit him. And then Matheson couldn't beat him, either in either 11 or 13. So that's what I was talking about. Mac wanted smart players and encouraged them to think for themselves. Yeah. Not in those days. Later on he did, but not in those days. Ira Thomas was very close to him and for a very long time was a veteran catcher, and he helped. And after Bender quit pitching, he was a pitching coach for the A's as long as he was healthy. Maybe if you'd asked me that when I was a year younger, I could have told you. Yeah. Yes. In the early years of the in the early years and the later years of the dead ball era, John McGraw had a lot more money to work with than Mac did. The Federal League caused some dissension on the Athletics. Even though they won in 1914, it was beginning to affect them. And the team got old. Bender got old, Plank got old, Baker quit, in effect, over money. Mac knew, and over many years, not just the dead ball era, knew that he could not pay his players what they deserved. He knew it. He was quite frank about it, and it bothered him. And when he sold Cochran later on, when he sold Jack Barry in 1915, when he did those things, he would tell them, you're going to a place where you can make more money than you can here. And he was happy for them. And he knew that. And when he had the money, he was happy to pay them. But there were a lot of years in Philadelphia, both then and in later years to come, where he didn't. In World War I, he had another whole crop of young players to replace the old ones from 1914 and 15. He had a big crop of young pitchers, young players, who went off to war and lost it. and came back no good anymore, in effect. And that set him back. And it took him until 1921 to begin to rebuild. And it's interesting. Every year, he finished one place higher. Every year, one place higher. And ran into the Yankees in 1926, 27, 28, and couldn't beat them. But he had the team that then became the great team, 29 to 31. And he had the misfortune to reach the top again at the beginning of the Depression. And that just, I mean, Philadelphia and Pennsylvania in general, economically, were very, very hard hit in the Depression. So his timing was poor in that regard. Well, we can only speculate on that, but he wouldn't have had to sell the players that he did in the early 30s. He actually finished, I think, third in 32, and then he just didn't have the money and had to sell. And he sold Mickey Cochran only because Cochran had a chance to be a manager. He sold him to be a playing manager, and he could make a lot more money that way. And he would never stand in the way of any of his players who had a chance to become a manager somewhere else. And Cochran was a good one until he got hit in the head. Sure. He had opportunities to sell pieces of the team, wouldn't do it. He expected, this is going to be a long answer, but I'll shorten it. He expected his sons, Roy and Earl, to succeed him in running it. By the time they did, well, long before the time they did, but when they finally took over, in 1951, they were really Tweedledum and Tweedledee. They ran it into the ground, and it didn't take them long. And they were broke. And Connie Mack now is 90 years old, and he's in real danger of dying broke because they lost so much money, and they were broke, and they were in debt. From 1951 to 54. And they had a chance to sell in those years. It didn't go through for more reasons than we have time to talk about, but it didn't go through. And they never should have wound up in Kansas City anyhow, but that's a whole another three or four chapters in volume three as to why they did. But so yes, there were people ready to put money into the team in the 40s. But one caveat was often without Earl and Roy. And that wasn't going to go. Okay, last question. Oh, that was definitely a part of it. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.